Hello and welcome. This is the fifth edition of the community newsletter interview portion, the uplink. And today I'm sitting down with someone not from the community, not in the traditional sense at least, but someone from our own development teams, if you find that funny. I'm talking with, of course, Callum McCall, one of our, I guess you might say, designers here, though I'm sure there's probably more fancy title like chief architect you might find. How are you?
Not chief architect, no, but anything with the word chief in it
Chief
sounds
architect.
good.
Yeah, well,
Yeah,
executive
hello Henry,
architect then.
thanks for having me. You are right there where working for Stardock, it can be a little hard to define some roles. One of the perks, I suppose, of working for a smaller company is that you do have a lot more flexibility in what you actually do. So my official title at the moment is designer on Siege of Centauri and also Star Control Origins, because I'm working on the DLC for that. But in the past, I've been, what was it, product manager for Ashes Escalation, making videos. So it kind of all jumps around the place a bit, which I think keeps it interesting.
If I remember correctly, I think that your absolute first job was actually just doing the balancing for Ashes.
Well, no.
Or was
My
that?
actual first ever Stardock job was this episode of The General's Gentleman is sponsored by Ashes of the Singularity. Take control of massive battles in an epic scale RTS where you control thousands of units with up to, what is it, 16 players per game. It's the biggest RTS to date. So the way that I started for Stardock was, well, I can give you the whole life story if you want to. That's what we're here for, isn't it, Henry?
Sure. The first official question, which we haven't actually got to yet, is to tell us about
Yeah,
yourself
sorry,
and what you
joking.
do here. So we've kind of just barreled into
Okay.
that. Go ahead.
Well, shall we be let's be chronological then. Let's be good
Chronological.
obedient podcasters. So as for some information about myself, I mean, I'm Callum, I'm from Australia, and I'm still here despite working remotely for Stardock. And that's why I get along with Henry so well, because him and I are both subjects of Her Majesty, unlike all the Stardock Americans. So gaming's obviously a massive part of my life, and it encompasses many things. Working for Stardock, making videos on my YouTube channel, I do shoutcasting, I do reviews and video essays on my own private channel, and a lot of that bleeds over into the Stardock channel. My other interests, I'm really into Brazilian jiu-jitsu. I do that twice a week or so. I like trying out different things. Like, I've recently got into bouldering and so forth. I like learning philosophy and psychology, listening to a lot of podcasts and reading a lot of nonfiction. And I think that it's all relevant to game design.
Well, certainly to study Sun Tzu. I mean that's all. What's it? What's the first rule again of the Art of War? All warfare is just a form of deception. I think it is. Or all warfare is just deception. Some of that. Remember correctly. No one
I
says a
really
bit about
should
Sun
read that
Tzu.
book. It's sort of embarrassing that I haven't. Yeah. You know what? That's going to be on my list.
Yeah, no, I think I went through it when I was like 20 or something, and I've forgotten pretty much all of it. Although there's a great album by the metal, like rock band Sabaton, which is built around Sun Tzu for some reason, and famous battles.
A lot of games have loading tips where it's a Sun Tzu quote. I'm sure there's some in like the old Call of Duty games. They used to have quotes. And I think there's other RTS games or strategy games. There's like some random quote there from Sun Tzu.
I mean, I think that there's a when it comes to Sun Tzu, I mean, even in the very fictional, fantastic world of strategy games, which is primarily what you and I are involved with and have, experience with Stardock, obviously, is the idea that it's all based as management of information and resources and kind of figuring out how to also deceive the enemy, because a lot of it is like, especially like something like StarCraft, for example. Is like what you open and build. Do you do a proxy, pylon, or do you, do a Zerg rush, etc. Like that kind of thing is very fundamental to most forms of strategy games, I'd argue.
Let's be honest, you always Zerg rush all the time. It's the only way to play.
Well, for me, it'd be cheesy tactics as Protoss because I am a Protoss player, which.
Yeah, of course. I can tell.
A move, a move.
By
Although
the way,
I
that's
do
a
like Terran.
I'm dissing you right now.
I know.
Just
I know,
so we're clear.
It's fine. I'm used to jealous people who don't understand the power of A Move or of Stalker Blink. Anyway, I'm here to talk about StarCraft though. So maybe we should talk a little bit actually, because next proper question is actually how you got involved with shoutcasting, because you did mention touch on that just very briefly. And
this is relevant to this StarCraft, man. My brain wanted me to say StarDock, and then my brain wanted me to say Star Control, and then I had to persevere to say StarCraft.
There's a lot of stars in my brain. There's StarDock, there's Star Control, there's StarCraft, there's Star Wars, Star Trek. There's so many stars.
Okay, so always thought shoutcasting was cool. I really got into StarCraft 2 when it came out, and we didn't have video, but like my wallet is StarCraft 2. I have these StarCraft like badges on my desk. I really like StarCraft for a lot of reasons. And I talk about it a lot when I do dev journals and so forth, analyzing game design. And so when it came out, I was watching a lot of shoutcasts, and I thought like, wow, that's awesome. I just loved the energy and the passion and the hype that they were able to deliver. And so I always wanted to try it. And then like one day I did, just on my own, I tried casting, and it was just bad and awkward, and I didn't stick with it. But then maybe about 6 months or a year later, one of my my best friend now, him and another group of IRL friends, we were getting really into Command and Conquer Generals Zero Hour, and so we were playing it at all these lands that we would go to. We would you know, have like big team games and have little 1v1s, and my friend Blake was pretty new to it, and so he was kind of bad. And so I was like, oh man, Blake, we should watch some Zero Hour shoutcasts so you can learn how to play Zero Hour. Because from watching so many Day 9 dailies and whatever other StarCraft casts, I learned so much and got so much better at StarCraft. So I thought surely there would be some Zero Hour shoutcasts that we could learn from, and he could improve that way. So then one day he came over, I think, and we went on YouTube and we fired up Zero Hour shoutcasts, and what we found, we weren't particularly impressed with. There were some people doing it, but you know, it definitely wasn't the same caliber as the professional StarCraft casters, Tastosis and such.
From what I recall, I think they only started really pushing that stuff with CNC3. Like during Generals, I don't think there was any real demand for that, either professionally, like in the community.
Sure, but even the CNC3 stuff, like that was you know, EA professionals, mm-hmm. but that only lasted a few months. This was like 2010. This was post StarCraft 2. We were just landing for fun, and it was community members. But basically, the point is we thought, wow, like we could do better than these guys. I reckon if we could try this and we could do it, and it seemed like a massive niche that was there to be waiting for us. And so we just tried it. One, you know, came over. We had some energy drinks. We got keen. You know, that was our thing, because one of the problems we had with some of the Zero Hour casters is they didn't have much energy. They were kind of low energy, and it made it didn't really hook you as much as the high energy casters.
It's because
casters.
They didn't have a sponsorship with Monster Energy, of course, or Mountain Dew. That's the
or
ticket.
Or Audible.com.
Yes, this is not sponsored by any of these products, I must mention. So it seems pretty straightforward in regards to how you got involved, like starting doing this. But then I do remember that you moved on to Comedy of Heroes, of course. Was that the first game or only the second?
I think the second was actually StarCraft 2. It was just me casting that. And then there was local LAN events here in... There was StarCraft tournaments, this massive LAN event called RFLAN. And so I would live cast that, not with Blake, but with another guy who I'm still friends with. And then, maybe 6 months later, a few months later, then we started doing, well, at least I started, like I did it first, and then Blake kind of joined me afterwards. Blake's my friend, because like he didn't know a lot of other RTS games. I kind of had to introduce him to Command & Conquer 3, Red Alert 3, Company of Heroes 2, all these RTS, Dawn of War 2. I think he played a little bit of that. So... Yeah, I don't remember where Company of Heroes came in, but Company of Heroes 2 ended up being our, and is still our 2 RTS game that we cast on our private YouTube channel, General's Gentleman. I say private as opposed to Stardock. So Zero Hour and Company of Heroes are the main two things that we juggle. But then we also do get all other kinds of RTS games, just things that we personally enjoy. We've gone down paths of trying to do League of Legends shoutcasting professionally like years ago. And that didn't go anywhere. We did a lot of like, again, local LAN events and such. But in the end, we just still pump out casts every week for our favorite RTS games.
I think that, well, it's obvious that you found a niche, whereas, like, you know, MOBA's a bit more, or certainly were, now probably less so, kind of crowded. But then that leads on to the next question, because I know something about this, but I'm going to let you tell us a story. Because then, when you were doing Shoutcast, in particular with Company of Heroes 2 and Generals, you got involved with Stardock. And I think we did touch on that briefly earlier, but do you want to tell that story, how that happened?
Yeah. So basically, I was working in like a part-time retail job for years and trying to grow up my YouTube channel, grow up my Patreon and ad revenue and stuff. And it didn't quite work out. I was kind of, the company I worked for shut down, and then I was like doing YouTube full-time and kind of running out of money. And then one day I woke up to an email from a guy called Brad Wardell, the CEO and president of Stardock Entertainment. And he said, "Hey, Callum, I really like you. I'm the CEO and president of this game dev company. I really like your videos. I've been watching you for a while. I've shown some of your what makes RTS games fun design videos to some of my design team. We've learned a lot from you. Thanks so much. By the way, we have this game coming out soon. It's called Ashes of the Singularity Escalation. We hope you'd like it. Here's some Steam keys. Thanks, Brad." Something like that. And so I was like, whoa, that's amazing. This guy noticed me, because you never know who's watching your videos. And so I responded. I was like, "Oh, hey, thanks, Brad. That's awesome. Actually, I'm looking to do this YouTube thing full time. Would you be interested in sponsoring my channel?" And he just responded with, "Yeah, sure. All right. Where do we go from here?" And then I had to come up with this, like, what do I do? I had to come up with this kind of this contract of, well, I'll do these pre-roll ads, like, you know, the thing that I read out earlier. There was like a 15-second ad for each Stardock game, or the major recent Stardock games, that we would put in front of some of our RTS videos, you know, very targeted advertising. I would also do like a Let's Play, or we would do like a shoutcast of Offworld Trading Company or Ashes a couple of times a month. So it was about giving some exposure to Stardock's games, because it was all relevant strategy games to our viewer base. And then it worked up.
I was going to ask, I'm curious, because how much familiarity do you have with Stardock games before then?
Okay, so I played Ashes of the Singularity in beta, the original beta, and I thought it was cool. I was like, hey, this game seems fun. And I played it. I actually wrote an article. There's an article from like 2016 that I wrote about Ashes before working on it. And I did a review for Offworld Trading Company, and I really loved that game. And so I don't know what exactly it was that Brad initially stumbled upon. It may have been I know he watches my Company of Heroes casts. It may have been like the Offworld Trading Company review. It was certainly also my What Makes RTS Games Fun video essay series. So all of those things he watched and enjoyed. But I also remember playing Galciv 2 like as a kid. So I knew, and also I used Start 8 on multiple PCs, and I didn't know that was Stardock. So tangentially, I kind of knew Stardock. But just wrapping that up, I went from doing sponsored videos to then I was giving some feedback about Ashes, because that escalation was just kind of had just launched at the time, and Brad really liked what I had to say, and then he offered me to work as a design consultant, where I was just giving really structured feedback. And it was a part-time thing, but I was trying really hard to be really meticulous in what I was presenting, and I would Photoshop up these little mocks, like, hey, this is what it would look like if you were to change, you know, the layout of this thing. And I was very thorough, and obviously Brad liked what I was doing and then offered me to work full-time as a designer on Ashes. And yeah, I worked on Ashes for about a year and a half, and then I jumped over to Star Control, and then now most of my time is on Siege of Centauri, but also still the Star Control DLCs.
An illustrious career so far. So, yeah, which leads us on to, of course, the next in here, and this is a question that I think is going to be a bit tricky, because you've had quite a while now, I would say, and across multiple genres as well, because you've worked on RTS, you've worked on basically adventure action RPG games, but I tend to describe Star Control that way. It's action adventure RPG. It's not a pure RPG experience, not a pure action or adventure game. It's a combination of elements. And of course, you've worked on a tower defense game, which is, some would argue, maybe a subgenre of RTS, but it isn't really. Like, it's a strategy subgenre, but it's a different beast altogether, really, I think. So you've worked on three different games with very different genres. At this point, right now in this said illustrious career, what in your opinion are the cardinal rules of video game design? What are the footnotes or the guiding path, you would say, or the true way of the warrior for working on just about any kind of video game?
Aside from allowing you to pet the dog?
Obviously, that Twitter account. Yes, obviously you have to pet the dog. I mean, that's like Chekhov's gun, right? If you have a dog in a video game, allow me to pet it. If you have a gun, if you have a loaded gun at the start of a story, that gun best be fired by the end of the story. Like, you can't just have a dog in a game and can't pet it. But apart from the Chekhov's dog, I guess, what in your opinion currently are like the cardinal rules, the top sure. tips and so you can give?
I'm definitely underqualified to talk about the cardinal rules of video game design, but I certainly can answer for RTS game design, because okay, that's my jam.
You can limit it to strategy then. I mean, that's probably fair.
Yeah.
Because that's something which you really steeped in.
Sure. So I've written a lot about this. Again, my series is called specifically What Makes RTS Games Fun. And the summary that I think is crucial in any RTS game is two things, is interaction. So you have to interact between the two players, because that's what is an RTS game as opposed to a city builder? It's the fact that you're playing against someone, and that someone certainly can be a computer, it can be an AI, it can be a campaign, but that's interaction inherently. And number two is decisions. You have to actually be making decisions about what you're doing. You shouldn't just fall into this automated pattern of do that. You can have a build order, but there should be doing things for a reason. You shouldn't and you should be forced to change those things.
Having more than one way to play, so it's forced to decide which way you're playing.
Yeah, and you know, there's so much to talk about in those things. It can be interaction in terms of strategy. So interaction can be you scout your opponent's base and you see that your opponent has 5 airfields and you go, oh, that's a lot of aircraft, a lot of sky factories. I better start building some anti-air. That's interaction, because you're seeing what your enemy's doing and now you're responding with some anti-air of your own. So there's interaction in terms of strategy and composition, or it can be in terms of micro, in terms of how do you position your units, what sort of techniques do you do to improve things. So whether that's like splitting up your banelings, splitting up your marines so the banelings do less damage, and then your opponent can respond, they can, you know, manually move the banelings back. It should feel like you're actually fighting someone. You know, whether a tank's moving to get rear armor or a flank on your tank destroyer, so now you have to rotate it so it maintains that turret rotation, the direction against the enemy. It can be in terms of just looking at how many workers they have and going, well, he's probably gonna rush me because he doesn't have any dudes on gas. So you should be always thinking about what you should be doing and why you're doing it, and you should be able to change that on the dime.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly for, and that obviously bleeds over to tower defense, is interaction in a way that, depending on what waves the enemy has, then you want to adjust your towers. You don't want to just spam the same towers over and over again. You should be able to go, wow, there's a lot of eradicators coming in. They have a lot of shields. I better get my pulse cannons to ignore the shields. Having that dynamic response keeps things fresh, keeps you on the edge, makes it feel like you're always being challenged.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I can also see the kind of the mindset, especially in the case of RTS, having like that two-track train of thought, because as it's usually described, being macro versus macro. So you have decisions you're making like on an instantaneous basis on what you're doing with the units, but also decisions based upon the long sight of what you're going to be doing like 10 minutes from now, 20 minutes from now, even, especially in like longer form RTS games like Ashes, I personally would argue, which can be interesting. To what degree you focus on one or the other in the game design in turn? Because some games focus one, others really focus on another.
Well, I think they're both interchanged. Strategy and interaction can be interwoven. Certainly, that's at least what I find fun in RTS games, and that's more the competitive perspective of it. Because with RTS games, the other really big part of it that a lot of the more casual players enjoy is the idea of this sandbox kind of creativity where you can sit back, build a pretty base, have this massive army of artillery posts, turtle up, and then you can push out. So people enjoy RTS for different reasons.
Power fantasy.
I think it's important.
Definitely a power fantasy element.
Yeah, and I think it's important not to get overly fixated on like one perspective. You have to really think about what other players enjoy. So I think you got to be flexible in what you allow people to get out of an RTS game. It can be this, you know, competitive interaction experience, or it can be sit back, relax, turtle up. Basically, an RTS game should be about giving players tools to use. And then how they use those tools is up to them. And one thing that I really like about escalation is that we have so many lobby options. You can disable air units, you can disable Terranium, you can play in a very flexible way. And I think that's important to give longevity with the skirmish and the multiplayer.
Something, I'm going to actually alter discussion a little bit here, because I'm going to move something else further up, which was a question for later, but it's going to be now. But something which I've noticed and I think doesn't get talked about nearly enough, once or twice, and like once a full moon, blue moon, you might see it, but in general, it doesn't get discussed very often, is the importance of good unit design. Because I think that one of the things that some more recent games are lacking, especially with RTS, is the idea of units which feel like they have a lot of personality. And some arguably might go a bit too far that way sometimes. Like, you want to be careful about having like a unit that's a bit too overpowered, or just kind of a bit too gimmicky, because you can get that. But in general, I would make the argument that something that was very appealing early on with RTS games was the idea of having these units which had a lot of personality, especially when you consider like how primitive the graphics were like back in the day. I mean, they had almost no pixels because they had to have a lot of them on the screen, and computers were just not capable of pushing high fidelity graphics with lots of units like that back in the day. Even now, like, they can still struggle with certain things, but I do think that having personality in units, having ones which look, sound, and act unique, is a huge part of what makes a good, in the case of RTS design. And this is the point where I'm going to bring forward this question, because And this is a question that I'm fine if you don't want to answer this or want to take a while to think about it still, but every game you've played, every one in your entire life to this day, what is your favorite RTS unit?
So my answer to this is probably not expected, because I think when people are asked this question, you see, you know, like, what's your favorite RTS unit? It's generally the big things. It's generally
Mammoth
the
tanks.
Baneblade. Mammoth Tanks, Baneblade, the Galactic Colossus. It's those big, flashy, cool units. And I totally get why, because they're fun to use. But my answer is what perfectly embodies the philosophy of interaction and strategy, and that is the Nuclear Battlemaster tank from Command and Conquer Generals. From Zero Hour specifically. And the reason why is because, so in Zero Hour, you have sub factions. You have China, and then one of the sub factions is China Nuke. And one of the quirks of China Nuke is that their Battlemaster tanks, they're a nuclear variant, and they have pros and cons. So they're faster, they have more damage, and they fire radiation on the ground. Their weakness is that when they're destroyed, they detonate with a nuclear explosion that damages all units nearby. And that's both friendly and enemy units. And so when you're using the Nuke Battlemasters, you have to be very careful, because if you have five Nuke Battlemasters and one of them detonates, you can create a chain reaction where the first one blows up the second one blows up the third one, and in the blink of an eye, your entire army is just deleted in front of you. But at the same time, the Nuke Battlemaster can be used devastatingly. If you charge it at the enemy and it detonates, you can blow up all of your enemy's units. Their infantry takes damage, their tanks take a bit less damage. So it creates really exciting situations where the amount of micro that's being used, where you're targeting the Nuke Battlemaster, so then they pull it back so it doesn't detonate near their units, or they charge it in, so then you have to focus it down really quickly before it blows up, or you split your units up away from the Battlemaster. It's really fun, and you can use it in different ways. You can suicide it down towards the enemy's worker line, so while they're all harvesting the supplies, either they blow up the Battlemaster and it kills all your workers, or their workers, or they just ignore it, in which case it kills all your workers anyway. So it's a really flexible unit to use from a strategy perspective. Do I harass with it? Do I have it in my main army? Do I use it for defense because it's quite mobile? And then when it comes to the micro, how do I use it? You know, do I use it defensively? Like, do I try and consolidate them together? Because they get horde bonus if you have five Battlemasters together, they actually gain rate of fire. So it's kind of like an opposite incentive where you want to clump them up for better rate of fire, but if you clump them up, they can blow up. So, and we do a lot of shoutcasting. My friend Blake and I, on our YouTube channel, and we've casted so many games of Zero Hour, and Nuke Battlemasters is just one of the most fun games to use, to cast, see how the players use it, and it's really exciting. And there's also an upgrade called the Isotope Shells, which removes the detonation from the Nuke Battlemaster. And so it means that you won't damage your own units, but you also won't damage your enemy units. So even that upgrade is very situational, because maybe you want it, maybe you don't, depending on how you want to position and use that unit. So and Zero Hour has some similar examples of units like that, but I think that's certainly the best example. And just giving so much depth into a unit that's just kind of a tank, it's a simple unit when you think about it, but in the end it becomes really fun.
Yeah, that's actually mentioned the isotope upgrade for that. That actually, personally, I prefer the for those kinds of upgrades to call them side grades. And there's a few different games that do that. One which did it quite a bit was actually Grey Goo, with mixed results. Although that was interesting because you could like sacrifice one ability for another free unit. And there's a few different RTS games that do try to do that to varying degrees of success, I'd argue. It's probably only fair that I also answer the question then, because it is a tough question. It is tricky to answer, but I'm actually going to go for something which I think you're going to appreciate, because it's along the similar lines of saying a unit which is based around how you interact and especially how you respond to another player, to the faction, and having a double-edged sword with it as well to some degree. And that's going to be the Sentinel. So in the game.
Which Sentinel?
Sentinels. I'll explain. Sentinels from the game Homeworld Cataclysm, although it's now called Homeworld Emergence. Now,
every RTS game has a Sentinel of some kind.
Yes. I think you've probably heard me talk about the game before, because actually it's one of the games that the developers of Sin's Sword of Empire, this is sort of connection right here, worked on before Sin's, because they were members of Barking Duck Studios that they spent with, like, three different studios, one of which then also made a couple of the games as well. But the point is, the Sentinels in Cataclysm are basically these very tiny, tiny units. They're absolutely minuscule. They move slowly. They're not very, like, effective as an attack unit at all. However, they have two extremely powerful abilities. The first is that you can use multiple sentinels to create a formation around a large unit, say, you know, typically a capital ship, like your own mothership or like a big cruiser, and they will form a shield. And depending on the upgrades, the shield can block basically almost anything. So you can create like a really tough fortified defense. The downside of that, however, is that they are slow, so that means that your big ship will itself have to reduce its speed in order to, you know, keep the protection of the sentinels. Also, if the enemy is smart, they can, you know, prioritize an individual sentinel, and like once one of them is dead, then that kind of has a hole in the shield. So it's pretty cool that way. But also, they do have a very effective gun, but it's a close range kind of weapon. So you can effectively use them to either try to corner someone, especially when the enemy is looking and taking out units. You can use it effectively as an anti-fighter screen, or you can use it as a you know, this huge fortification shield, effectively, for your big units. But in turn, again, the big units have to be very slow. So it's one of those units which has multiple uses, and I think that there's a few examples of it across RTS, really. It was tempting to say just Kirov, because, you know, Kirov. But I do see a point and about the importance of units which have multiple uses and kind of things you can adapt a core situation.
Yeah, because that's fundamentally interaction and decisions. It all fits into that. You have to think about, again, how do you want to use this unit, and you will change it depending on what your opponent's doing.
Good answer.
The one caveat, though, is like a unit has to be relevant to the game. So Zero Hour is all a game about micro and fast-paced combat. Having a unit like the Nuclear Battle Master wouldn't make sense in Escalation, because it's obviously a very different game. So the units kind of need to fit in to the focus of what that RTS game is.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so with the discussion about video game design out of the way, we're going to move on to next question. And this is going to be, I think this might be interesting, because I've not discussed this with you yet about what you think this is, the answer is here. To date in your career, what has been the greatest challenge you have had to overcome? Specifically talking, of course, about like game design, but if you want to talk on like some Shaka stuff as well, that's fine as well. What is the biggest challenge you've had to overcome?
So I can't think of a specific instance or a specific thing, but I think generally having to learn so much and being so unknowledgeable, because my entrance to the industry didn't come from studying at university and getting a degree, having all that knowledge from that. Or, you know, being a self-taught programmer who made my own little mod or indie game. My entry came from making a YouTube channel and making YouTube videos. And then so when it comes to interacting with engineers, and all of a sudden there's all these technical constraints and all of these things that are important, and all these conversations that come up about, you know, things that I don't know what they mean, like FEM, ray tracing, LOD, MIPPing. I know what these things mean now, but it's been very gradual over, you know, years of learning what these things mean, and having to learn the language of how do I change things in Star Control? What does this XML file mean? What does this magic number mean in the CSV file for Ashes? So just having to acquaint myself with terminology, with how the file structures work, what, just knowing what to do. And so much of that is asking people, just whenever I get stuck, just like, hey, Rob, how do I do this? Nathan, what does this mean? Scott, this effect isn't working. Can you show me how to do it? Ben, this unit's targeting isn't working. How do we fix it? Just a lot of iterative asking questions. I guess the other part of that, the other challenge is being limited with engineer time. And, you know, there's always awesome suggestions that we get, like, hey, we should add this feature. We should add this quality of life interface. We should fix this bug. And
scope creep.
Only a fraction of those things can ever be done. Well, okay, so you have 1 week or you have a month update. What do you want to do? I would love to add this feature in, but, you know, we should probably fix these bugs. Or, you know, are these bugs that important? It depends on again, like, what it is. You have to make that decision. You can't have it all. You can't have your cake and eat it too. And yeah, we're working on games that have already been released, like Escalation. Obviously, it doesn't have as much time and focus as a new game like Star Control or Siege, that we have, you know, an entire team of people working on it. You don't just have a single engineer. So having to make those decisions about what do we prioritize, and you always sort of underestimate how long it actually take for an engineer to fix. Well, it's very simple. Just change this thing. And no,
I think
it's not simple.
I think there's some kind of Powell Hill to point out about the kind of tactical thinking in playing the game and tactical thinking in making the game.
Well, it's managing resources. That's
yeah,
what RTS
it's
is.
Management. It's just all management.
Yeah.
No, that's. I think that's a good point about the constant challenge to learn and adjust, because I think there's a good deal of people who, I mean, even for myself, I have to admit, like, there's a good deal of like stuff which I imagine is like, why don't we just do this? But then the reality is, well, there's all these, you know, roadblocks.
There's
like,
reasons. Yeah, it's technical reasons often are the reason why. Or there's other considerations.
Yeah, so I've more than once as well seen examples, even amongst modders, like people who you think should know better in some ways. Our modders are great, but I've seen it in other games, shall we say, where a modder has kind of suggested, well, I just want to put these amazing like units into a game and these super high resolution textures, etc. And a developer themselves, an actual programmer, comes down and says, that's impossible, the engine will break. And they're like, no, it won't. Are you arguing with me? The engine will break. I'm telling you, don't do that. Design your units, design your models and your meshes to be, you know, lower polygon counts. That's the ticket. And they don't, and the game breaks. I mean, especially in the case of Sins, actually. Again, our modders are pretty efficient about what they do, actually, by and large. But they definitely are like, there's always that like pushing things as far as they will go until the engine just will say nope. And I think especially in one of the recent mods by the Stellar Palace guys, the models are gorgeous, but if you actually zoom in on them, like there's a moment where the engine goes, yeah, fine, it's fine. So like you can tell like the engine's like, I can barely handle this, but any more detail, any more polygons, and I will completely implode. So, and that's just modern, of course, when you do like actual, you know, when it comes to the tweaking with the engine, there's so many things can go wrong with it. It's always fun. So, a couple more questions and then I think we'll wrap up. This one, I'm interested in this one as well. Are there any heroes who have either helped you personally or just inspired you? So people who, you know, either have been instrumental in your own, you know, development as a game designer, or people who've just simply been inspiring, you know, kind of like, I want to be that kind of person.
Yeah, from YouTube, there certainly has been. So Total Biscuit, rip Total Biscuit, in terms of the way that he would talk about things, and he was a very direct, ethical person in how he would, you know, deal with disclosures and things like that, and just being a beacon of sensibility in that sphere, which can often be filled with crazy people. And I mean, also like various shoutcasters.
I think you mentioned Day Nine.
Day Nine, certainly in terms of his dailies for his analytical stuff, really thorough, really awesome stuff. But yeah, other shoutcasters like Joe Miller, League of Legends, D-Man, just the level of energy that they have, the level of hype they have is amazing. Cybert, one of the old CNC casters, we ended up being good. We are good friends, and we did a bunch of videos together. I think from the game design perspective, I would say Greg Black, the lead designer on Red Alert 3. He was one of the designers on CNC 3. And I think in a lot of ways, Greg Black and I have very similar ideas of what makes RTS games fun. I certainly don't know how he would articulate it, but looking at the design of Red Alert 3, which was his pet project, his baby, it is all about interaction, very quirky, micro, very interesting units that have a lot of different ways of using them. It's very clean in terms of how, well, the flea jump from the sickle, it's one click, it's one ability, yet it has 9 different use cases where you can use it in all of these situations to dodge a Vindicator bomb projectile, to jump on infantry, to jump over walls, to harass harvesters, to go up terrain, and so forth. And I think Red Alert 3 is certainly one of my favorite RTS games.
Bit underrated for sure.
Top three. Yeah, top three, top five. And I think he's...
I think personally, yeah, I would... Given, so go on.
He's given me just a very clear vision of like, well, what's really fun from units? What's cool to use? And, bears, there's so many examples of just amazing units, and just what the focus of the game was is what I want in RTS games, which I think is perhaps a problem, because I don't think most people want a Red Alert 3 style RTS game. Most people want like a CNC 3 style RTS game, more economy focused, more base building. And so again, you have to reconcile like what are my own personal preferences with what are the market realities.
I would actually be interested personally if there was a discussion between Greg Black and Dustin Bardo, actually. Because Dustin, people often, I don't think, realize this, but Dustin was one of the people who was, I think, most responsible. I could be wrong about this, though, but from the best of my knowledge, was kind of one of the key designers for Red Alert 2, which is personally my favorite Red Alert game. And certainly seen, I'd even perhaps argue CNC game of all time. And of course, he went on to then work on StarCraft 2 and Heroes of the Storm. So having those two together and discuss like the different pitfalls and challenges of RTS design would be very interesting, I think. Red Alert 2 had a lot of cool ideas, a lot of cool implementation of stuff, but also definitely things that were like, they didn't have time, I think, to really kind of fix properly. Like the super weapons were really cool, but they didn't really have a proper counter for them all the time, so they just kind of went, we're going to put energy shield in the game so you can instantly make your base invulnerable as long as you were quick enough to catch it. So different things like that. And then, of course, with Red Alert 3, you had a few things. I personally would argue whether the ability progression was necessarily the best implementation. I think that Community of Heroes had a much better progression for that. And, of course, like, you have the different journals as well. That kind of idea was, I think, better implemented. Or, in fact, about 0 hour. Anyway.
Well, Red Alert 3 embodies the interaction pillar in terms of the abilities really well. So you have like the cryo shot, rather than just, it freezes the units for X seconds and they will thaw out, but then you have to finish them off before they thaw out. And so it's very creative in that it forces the players to interact a lot more than just click here to kill stuff. So there's so many examples of amazing designs from Red Alert 3 that are applicable to other RTS games. See,
what would have been amazing with that is if you had a general who specifically specialized in cryotech, a bit like the 0 hour, except if they had Arnold Schwarzenegger play him as a parody of his own parody character of Mr. Freeze from Batman, There's nothing but ice puns all the time. I would have loved that, because I think one of the things that was cool about Red Alert 2 and 3 were just how really wacky things could get.
Yeah, it didn't take themselves too seriously, which I think is one way where many RTS games go wrong is they just take themselves way too seriously.
That's another hallmark of like StarCraft as well, and some of the things they do. with their games. Well, and Warcraft as well.
Well, yeah, StarCraft's a bit goofy. Like, it's not trying to be, you know, super realistic or whatever.
Although I think you have to be a bit careful with that as well, because I think there's still a place for more serious science fiction, of course, and definitely like original Brood War and kind of Conquer Tiberian universe.
Yeah, Company of Heroes, you know, that's a good serious because of the setting. It makes sense.
Oh, yeah, you can't make Light of World War II. Come on. no one's yet dead. Someday they will, and I dread that day. So, moving on. I think the last serious question we have here, unless we get into some more kind of casual conversation, is basically do you have any advice for the people when it comes to a YouTube career or to a video game career, basically working in the industry?
Well, I think when it comes to a YouTube career, I think the candid piece of advice is don't. YouTube is just so ridiculously oversaturated that if you want to, I want to be a full-time YouTuber. Yeah, you're probably not going to do that. And, you know, I didn't. Like, I tried to be a full-time YouTuber and I was unsuccessful and I ended up working for Stardock, which I think was much better. I'd certainly rather be in game dev than doing YouTube full-time. Not to say that you shouldn't do YouTube, and it's an incredibly fun and rewarding hobby. And it's, you know, one of the best things of my life that I've done. But yeah, you have to certainly go in with realistic expectations that YouTube is so overwhelmingly oversaturated. You're not going to get many views. And after years of finding a niche, that's probably the main advice, though, is find a niche. What are other people doing? And what can you do to stand out? I guess it's the same sort of thing for, like, games, because Steam is also very oversaturated. But find something that's sustainable. What do you actually like to do? Because you're gonna have to do it hundreds and hundreds of times, in my case thousands of times. And if you're not genuinely enjoying it, you're doing it because you want to get views or whatever, that you get burnt out. Oh, it won't get sustainable.
I have a brilliant idea for anyone out there looking for a YouTube career. Do a cooking show based on video games. I don't think that's been done yet. Probably has.
Nerdy Nummies? That's what I can think of. Well, it's not. It's like a, you know, cakes that are themed after Zelda or something.
More general cooking, perhaps, like, you know, I don't know. What can we do?
Yeah. But I have some, I guess, advice for the second part
of
getting
part.
Into the video game industry. And I think you and I are both pretty good examples of this, is take a non-conventional path, I think, is very important, because, yeah, you can go to university and get a degree, but how many other people are doing that? Thousands. Everyone is going to university and getting a degree. And when it comes to then applying for a job, like, what do you really have to offer? Whereas, you know, I guess my approach of creating content and writing and putting myself out there and having a niche of RTS games and doing shoutcasts and doing reviews and video essays for RTS, which was very underserved, very undersaturated for analytical content. There's so many amazing people on YouTube doing video essays about game design. Mark Brown and Game Maker's Toolkit's one of my favorite series. But no one's doing it for RTS games. Not many people are really doing that. So you can find a niche, whether it's making a mod about some crazy wacky game, whether it's making videos or writing. In Henry's case, he was basically a community manager of various Stardock games Discord servers, at least for Ashes of the Singularity, and you know, Stardock noticed, and like, well, Discord's really powerful. We need someone who can do this for us, and this guy's already doing it, so let's give him a job.
I kind of started with, like, other stuff as well, because I was doing stuff with mod teams. The first kind of really run of stuff with someone was actually for Petroglyph Games, actually. But then, as a fan of Ashes, I was running that sort of for a while until Bad Dunsmith was like, hey, we want to hire some community managers, want to apply? I guess real more the story here is get hired by Stardock.
Well, Stardock's certainly a unique company in that they have a lot of remote staff, and that's pretty unique to game dev. Most companies will not be interested in hiring anyone remotely. which
I would,
you know, can make it harder.
I would point out that we also have mutual friends as well who similarly don't work for Stardock, but got through into working in the industry through just like doing other stuff. Most notably,
like Balint.
Yeah, basically, like, yeah, Balint, for example.
Nekamar, but, yeah.
And funny thing is, I worked with him on a Homeworld mod for a time, which is how we got to know each other. And that was before he got a job working at Creative Assembly and before I got a job working for Stardock. So that happens, like, yeah. that does generally happen. Like, people making mods, making you
people know.
Video essays, doing just like running communities, etc., whatever, that is a pathway to then get into the industry if you're passionate about it and halfway good, I guess.
I guess the shorter answer to that is find what you want to do and just do it. And hopefully someone will notice and will want you to do that for them. And not to say that you shouldn't approach people and be like, hey, I'm a balanced designer on this mod. Maybe I could balance your game too, or whatever. But because it's not just about like proving that you're qualified. Like, do you have X qualification? It's also about demonstrating that you're a hardworking, industrious person. And anyone who is going to spend hundreds of hours working on their own mod or working on their own communities or working on their own videos for free or for very little money is going to have the kind of attitude and the level of conscientiousness that you want as an employee to work for you and have that genuine passion and that genuine motivation. And, you know, not to say that like getting a degree obviously isn't useful, but I think it can't be your be all end all. You have to do other things as well, or perhaps instead.
I think there's a degree of also the fact that so much of even the old guard of game dev is still like there was no, you know, game dev course or really kind of any like traditional pathway to becoming a game developer. They just simply started in the bedrooms or whatever, you know, started like putting together like, hey, this is cool, I'll try this, or like, I want to make my own Metroidvania game or whatever. And so there's kind of an element of certainly there is no actual like, traditional pathway. So it's like, hey, this person's doing stuff. I want to work with this person making and creating stuff. And that's kind of how a lot of stuff actually happens. Like, and even now, like a lot of the, I know that a lot of the old developers are now like many of them leave to play gaming and start making like smaller indie and AA studio, etc. So like, yeah, it's a lot of getting stuff out there and just doing stuff and finding people who also want to create those kinds of games, really. But yeah, I think that's a pretty good piece of advice just beginning to go off of. Like, hey, I know someone was out there hoping for like some kind of magical handshake or something. I don't know, like part of the Freemasons. That wouldn't be like a fraternity of game developers somewhere. If there is, I haven't been invited yet. Yeah, so I think that's all the main questions. Unless you had anything else you want to discuss about working for Stardock or any specific projects you're working on?
I mean, it's been an absolute blast working for Stardock. We're independently owned, so we don't have these corporate board of directors that are all wearing suits and are telling us to add in loot boxes to our games. So I feel really, really lucky. Not only am I working for a company all the way from Perth, Australia, but I'm working for an independently owned company. We have a great gaming culture. It's because, again, our bosses and our management are all gamers themselves, not Mr. Burns. So,
Mr.
Burns. Yeah, just...
I think you just think if you do a Kojima at this point, like spending all those years making a game series, and then Konami was like, we're gonna make a gambling machine out of all this. That's all we're doing now, gambling machines. Literal gambling machines. Oh, what happened? Right. What happened?
Well, yeah, I guess lastly, thanks to everyone who plays our games, who leaves feedback, who leaves us Steam user reviews. It's really helpful. And hopefully everyone picks up the latest game I've been working on, Siege of Centauri, and checks it out. I think it's turning out to be a really awesome game.
You're here first, folks. Go buy Siege of Centauri. not in any way biased whatsoever. That's a what's that? A general's gentleman promise, is that? But yeah, so I think that's a wrap.
Okay. Thanks, Henry.
Thank you, Callum.